lake. Knock. At least I'm 15 feet from the frozen shore when I hear it. The ice feels as solid as concrete, so I take another step. The Winnipegashish is like most of the Minnesota lakes, which remain frozen until spring. There's no chance of breaking through. At least, that's what my girlfriend Amy keeps telling me. Knock. I hear it cracking. We shouldn't go so far out. I hear something cracking. Is it the voice of my terrified boyfriend? I glare at her, or at least at the waddling bundle of winter coats which has devoured her without a trace. Somewhere in my head is faintly echoing the song, I will do anything for love, but I won't do that. I can't turn it off, but I do my best to turn down the volume so I can take another step. The thick blanket of snow which covers the ice keeps me from sliding, and if I really concentrate, I can pretend I'm walking on a regular, snowy field. Knock. It's just so hard with that sound like an ephemeral gunshot deep below the ice. Reverberating echoes insidiously linger somewhere between hearing and imagination. There isn't any reason to be afraid. If I'm trembling, it's just because it's 14 degrees outside. If you don't hurry up, I'm going to start stomping and throwing rocks, Amy shouts. Then we'll see how solid it really is. When did she get so far ahead of me? It's amazing how quickly the world can pass you by when you're staring at your feet. I scramble and slide another few shambling paces towards her. It's easier to move if I just focus on her. Don't look down. Don't look down. Don't look down. Knock. I look down. My body doesn't ask for permission first. I couldn't help it when the sound comes from directly below. I stare down into the blank patch of ice where the snow is thinner. I stare down into the blurred, blue-tinged face on the other side of the ice, and the hand which pulls back to. But the knock doesn't come. This time, the hand simply presses against the underside of the glassy window. Fingers spread wide in an intimate gesture as though inviting my touch from the other side. Seriously, dude, I'm going to freeze to death waiting for you. Amy. My voice is muffled from my scarf, but I can't look up from the lake. The face is coming into focus as it presses itself against the ice. Amy's skin had never been so pale, her eyes never so blue as those staring up at me from below my feet. I swear to God, if you pussy out on me, then I'm leaving your ass here. You said you'd go all the way out with me. Amy, the other Amy underneath the ice, her mouth is moving too. It isn't hard to read the lips when it's only one word. Run. You've got 5 seconds before I leave you here, my girlfriend shouted. 4. My knees buckle and I tumble down to peer into the ice. The other Amy isn't exactly identical. Her clothing is different, but familiar. She's wearing the purple sweater my girlfriend had been wearing yesterday when we'd gone out skiing together. Amy, wait! 3! I put my hand against the ice to mirror the girl underneath. She recoils immediately, her face twisting into that of desperate fear. Amy and I had been separated about an hour yesterday when she moved onto the advanced slopes while I practiced on the bunny hill. Had something happened to her during that time? 2! Knock. Her fist slamming into the underside of the ice, which vibrates underneath me. Then, slamming again, her movements frenzied in their urgency, her mouth straining as the silent scream rips from her body. The muscles in my leg coil beneath me, so tense they might as well be a brooding avalanche which needs only the weight of one more snowflake to begin. 1! This voice was different. It was still Amy, but it wasn't her. Like comparing a black and white photo to the original. All the colour, all the life, all the flavour had drained from the sound, leaving only the barest skeleton of her voice to hang in the frozen air. Run! Screams the girl under the ice, but I can't leave her there. I clasp my hands together to raise them above my head, smashing them into the window. It feels like the bones in my fingers are rattling together from the impact. Underneath, the girl is flinging her entire body against her side of the ice. I'm giving up on you, shouts the colourless voice. It sounds like it was farther away, but I don't look up. The girl below the ice is growing weaker with each strike. Her fingers are stiff and inflexible. Her mouth is still working over the same word again and again. But each iteration comes more slowly as her jaw resists the effort. I can break through, though. A deep hollow crack is resonating with each blow. Flurries of snow and ice shrapnel explode into the air as I strike the ice again and again. The girl below is sinking now, but I'm not giving up until glacial waters spray from the crack. One more blow and I'm through, plunging my hand into the numbing chill to seize the stiff fingers slipping deeper into the water. The skin is so hard and cold, it feels like metal. But life surges into her as she responds to my touch. She's gripping me now, and if I can just get a stable footing, I'll be able to haul her out. But she pulls before I have the chance, and I'm already tumbling into winter's gaping mouth. Water so cold that it burns my skin as it closes over my head. The other Amy braces her feet against the underside of the ice to pull me deeper still, launching off with her legs to send both of us spiraling downward. I can feel my eyes freezing all the way to my skull, but I can't shut them if I want any chance of finding the hole in the ice. She's still clinging to me, but a few wild kicks buy me enough space to start clawing my way back towards the surface. I expect my impetus to rocket me straight out of the water, but my head only slams into the impenetrable ceiling of ice. Even down here, it sounds a lot like the knocking I've heard since I arrived. My wild fingers probe the ice as far as I can reach in every direction. I went straight down and back up. The hole should be here. My skin revolts against the numbing darkness. The pressure in my lungs is mounting by the second. My body demands a scream, but I refuse to waste the last remnants of my precious air. I'm pulling myself along the bottom of the ice in every direction, but the strength in my fingers is swiftly fleeting. The hole is gone. The light is dying, and soon I will follow. Soon, but not yet. Fingers grip around my ankle. I'm not strong enough to kick free anymore. Another hand latches on and begins to drag me, and I know in my heart that it's the hand of death. Then, the pull. Water rushes over me, but I can barely feel it anymore. There's a momentary pause as the hands refocus their grip, and then the pull again dragging me deeper still. My last uncertain thought is wondering why it's growing brighter around me instead of darker. An idle curiosity of no consequence. She's pulling again, and my legs are pierced by a sudden wind. My brain can no longer process how that's possible. Then another pull, and the water begins to pour off my body. My head is suddenly clear from the water, and I collapse onto my back on solid ground. I'm coughing and spitting up water, but a warm blanket is being wrapped around me. My eyes flutter open from the life-giving pressure, and Amy is there. Amy, in her purple sweatshirt, perfectly dry. She's holding me to her and wailing incoherently. I must have passed out after that, but when I woke up, I was back inside her house. She said I must have been crazy to break the ice under me, but she ran back as soon as she saw me fall in. I was upside down in the water, but she managed to pull me out by my ankles. "What on earth were you thinking? You could have died." I didn't tell her about the face under the ice, though. I didn't ask her how she could have changed back into a purple sweatshirt in the middle of that ordeal. And above all else, I didn't ask her about the knocking I still hear resounding far above my head, almost as though it was coming from another world. I don't think I'm ready to find out. Night 40. The New You. 11:50 p.m. on New Year's Eve. The raucous beat of the music is echoed by the pulse in my veins. Iridescent lights lance through the air all around me, and the teeming heat of pressed bodies forces me to swallow a great lungful of heavy air, thick with sweat and cheap perfume. I can't be the only one who isn't dancing, but anyone who notices me will immediately recognize that I don't belong here. Smiles and sneers look the same to me, and all laughter is tainted with condescending jokes at my expense. Living with crippling anxiety is my personal nightmare. Just trying to start a conversation with someone feels like standing on the roof of a tall building. One little push, and I'm free. But the clenching knot in my stomach has me frozen in place. I must have started walking towards Chase at the DJ table a dozen times so far this party, but I've never gotten within a few feet before I had the irresistible urge to check my phone, go to the bathroom, or disappear off the face of the earth entirely. Guys like Chase don't look twice at girls like me. It doesn't matter if we all like the same music. It doesn't matter if there is electricity which ignites the air between us. Maybe things would be different if he was the one to say hi first, but how was that supposed to happen when I couldn't even get close to him? Looks like you could use a drink. I don't understand how I heard the words so clearly over the pounding music, but I didn't turn to the barman. Maybe if he thought I didn't hear him, he'd give up and leave me alone. Maybe two. What's your poison? He insisted. I don't drink, I dismissed him over my shoulder. You mean you didn't used to drink? I finally turned to see an elderly man with a closely groomed grey beard and a vest which fit so closely that it may as well have been sewn onto his skin. His dark eyes drilled into me with undisguised fascination. You didn't used to do a lot of things, he continued. There was a time when you never walked before, but then you started, and you haven't stopped since. Now it would be silly to say you don't walk, wouldn't it? You aren't even the same person who couldn't walk anymore. What do you mean, not the same person? A sudden lull in the music was punctuated by Chase's voice on the loudspeaker. 5 minutes to midnight. Who's ready to burn the rest of this year? He was answered by an overwhelming cheer, but the old man's words still clearly punctured the chaos. I mean, you're remembering someone else's memories, he said. Next year, you'll be new again, and then you'll remember all the memories you have now and think that they're yours. You'll have all the same habits and be afraid of all the same things because you think that's who you're supposed to be. But it's not. The new you will have to decide for herself whether she wants to keep copying a failing strategy or learn from it and try something else. I don't have a failing strategy. You don't even know me. How could I? He replied promptly. You're a blank slate tonight. Even you don't know you yet. So how about that drink? I nodded, not fully understanding why. He spoke with such a simple surety that I couldn't muster anything to refute him. The barman pulled a purple bottle from under the shelf and spun it deftly between his hands. A fountain of thick, rich liquid, like cough syrup, sprouted into a perfectly placed mug, which I hadn't noticed a moment before. What is it? Just what you need. Cheers. He poured a second glass for himself and toasted me. May we make room for new growth by pruning the dead branches, and may we leave what's dead behind. I took a long drink, forcing myself not to gag as the thick liquid dribbled down my throat like oil. He finished first, slamming his glass down upon the table and wiping his beard with the back of his hand. Before I had the chance to finish mine, the barman added, Those who die a little each night will never feel the pain of those who go all at once. You're one of the lucky ones. Huh? I wiped the last of the thick residue from my mouth. It's almost midnight. Are you ready to let the old you die? Almost midnight? I was running out of time. I felt a certain tranquility while walking towards the DJ table. The old me would have turned away by now, but I didn't slow down, even when Chase looked right at me. The electricity wasn't a barrier anymore. It was charging me. An exhilarating fuel which propelled me through the churning dance floor. I even allowed myself to step in time with the music, bobbing and swaying with the mesmerizing beat. It almost felt like I was flying until suddenly I was close enough to finally say, Hey, Chase. My wildest paranoia couldn't have prepared me for his reaction. Glancing up from his computer, Chase's face contorted into a horrified caricature of his usual self-assurance. He lurched out of his chair so fast that it tumbled backward. I rushed to help him, but that only made him kick the chair in my direction and scramble across the floor. The music was deafening this close to the speakers, but it wasn't enough to completely drown out the grotesque retching as he vomited onto the floor. Through the beat, I could still clearly hear the wailing sob rising in my throat as I sprinted away from him and towards the bathroom. I couldn't understand what happened until the burning began. My fingers gingerly grazed the swiftly swelling lumps in my face. I covered myself with my hands as I ran, brutally shoving my way through the crowd and then slamming through the bathroom door. A girl in a black sequin party dress dropped her makeup and screamed. I almost trampled her on my way to the mirror, but she wasted no time in ducking under the sink and crawling towards the door. Looking in the mirror, I honestly couldn't blame her. Some of the lumps in my skin were the size of golf balls, and they were growing by the second. The larger ones were actually wriggling, almost as though there was an insect squirming just beneath the skin. More lumps were appearing on my hands, and the itching burn radiating down my body left no ambiguity about what was happening under my clothes. I would have screamed if my tongue wasn't swelling too, but it was all I could do to just keep my airway clear. Then, the first boil popped, and I couldn't contain the howl which ripped from my lungs. I heard the door open again, but it snapped shut immediately. I couldn't tear my eyes away from the mirror. More boils were rupturing by the second, splattering the glass with thick purple syrup which clung on like long strands of mucus. More of them exploded in my mouth to trickle down my throat with the same oily taste of the drink. My hair was sliding from my scalp in great clumps, matted and greased with the bubbling purple liquid. The only thing keeping me from completely losing my mind was the sight of fresh pink skin which shone beneath the savage gashes in my face. The burn was growing more intense by the second, but each exploding boil revealed more healthy skin below it. I started ripping at the tattered shreds, peeling them off and dumping them in a soggy pile around my feet. Beneath all the skin sloughing off, I didn't even recognize myself. My new skin was lighter and clearer, and the new hair which sprouted was a short, ruffled blonde that was nothing like the long, dark hair which lay in clumps around my feet. Nothing was the least recognizable except my eyes, which were stretched wide with a familiar, anxious terror.
What the fuck?
Chase must have followed me into the bathroom. How long had he been watching? Long enough. I stepped away from the wet pile of old flesh that littered the ground. My clothes were still soaked in the liquid, though, and more chunks continued to rain out of my dress and down my legs. He looked like he was about to vomit again.
Hey, Chase, I want to try something. Come here.
He didn't move, but he didn't have to. I crossed the space between us more quickly than I thought possible. All at once, our faces were inches apart, but he didn't turn away. Outside, I could hear the countdown toward midnight.
5.
I pressed my finger to his lips to silence the budding question.
4.
I cupped his head in my hands and drew him towards me.
3.
I felt his hard lips soften against mine.
2.
The taste of his sweat as my mouth made its way down his neck.
1.
The squirt of blood through my teeth as they sank into his flesh. He was thrashing now, but each movement just forced my jaw to tighten until I could feel the first vertebra crunch under the pressure. All the shouts of,
"Happy New Year!"
drowned out his terminal scream, which strangled to a whisper when his trachea collapsed. Part of me died that night alongside Chase, but the old man knew what he was talking about. It's much easier to leave the dead parts of yourself behind than let them weigh you down forever. And for the first time in my life, I'm not afraid anymore. Night 41. Heaven keeps a prisoner. I wasn't ready when I died. The first illusion death stole from me was that my body was designed to perceive the universe around me. This is incorrect. The primary function of your senses is to stop yourself from experiencing the universe, whose infinite information would otherwise overwhelm and madden you. Eyes that once simplified the world into finite wavelengths of color closed for the last time, and then I saw everything. Ears once deaf to cosmic music, sung by the birth of stars, the communal heartbeat of the human race, and the haunting pop of each collapsing universe, now concealed them no longer. Even the distinction between senses decayed alongside my corporal prison. Starlight was a symphony that bathed me in warmth, and the heat in turn sang with such melodic iridescence that I was thrall to its majesty. It's impossible to measure how long I existed in such a state, but by gradual degrees I learned to separate my own thoughts from the medley of existence. The moment I began to comprehend my own internal voice, I became aware of a second voice that was not my own.
478 points. Hey, Jason, you closed that passenger pigeon room yet? I told you we don't do them anymore.
Hi. Excuse me, I said to the unrepentant chaos of the universe.
Here you go. Let me help you with that.
Remember what I said about the unfiltered synesthesia of my senses? Now, imagine being struck by lightning. A moment later, I found myself with hands and knees to collapse onto the stone floor with, my new lungs racing a marathon. Holy shit, did that hurt. I kind of wanted to do it again.
478 points, up from 314 last time. Solid performance.
I don't know what was harder to accept. My naked new body, which looked exactly like my old one, the colossal stone cathedral I suddenly found myself within, or the koala bear who sat in front of me, with a clipboard. He flipped another page.
Oh, that explains it,
the koala said in its soothingly gruff undertone.
50 points for loving someone and being loved in return. That's always a nice boost. Then you picked up another 20 from that album you released in the '80s. Touched more lives than you'll know with that one.
You were keeping score?
I hate to think what people got up to if we weren't. Lost 12 points because you stopped visiting Mark when he got cancer, but you got a few of those back when you played at his funeral. Hey, Jason, what's accepting your own imperfections worth? We got new numbers on that yet?
He was answered by the incomprehensible shriek of an eagle.
Shit, man, right back at you,
the koala hollered. Have you always been a koala? I asked.
Have you always asked stupid questions? You're lucky we don't dock points for that.
Kidding.
Sort of. This way now.
The koala slid the clipboard under his arm and began a brisk waddle. I hurried to keep pace, doing my best to avoid the absolute zoo which thronged the stone hallway onward, up the great diverging staircase with its goats and mountain lions, past the library whose shelves bustled with scaling monkeys, over the pools filled with playing otters and thrashing fish, beneath the gargantuan brass dome revolving with teeming flights of birds, the koala explaining as we went.
Long story short, if your life brought you more good into the world than evil, you're going to end up with more points than you started. Your 478 points can unlock any of the rooms on this floor, except for the Psyche and the Prophet, which are both 500. Think of your choice as an investment. Coming back as a human will be expensive, but you also have the greatest capacity to improve your score. The only rule is that you pick something on the right floor for your budget.
What would happen if I didn't have any points, or went below zero? I hadn't been aware koalas could even grin before this moment.
Generally, you just keep going down. It's hard to get out the negatives once you've started, so if you can't figure out how to do some good, then you're forced to keep choosing worse and worse punishment rounds. Get far enough negative, and suddenly you're looking at a demon or a vampire or the like. Some people actually do evil on purpose to aim for that, though. Can you imagine?
No, I answered honestly, but I'm beginning to.
All the animals you see are just spirits taking their new bodies for a test drive. Feel free to look around and, Jason, what's that thing doing up here? Keep the politicians downstairs, please.
The mournful shriek of an eagle somehow sounded like it had heard this joke far too many times. The koala sighed and threw his paws melodramatically in the air.
Kidding, kidding. God, what is this, a morgue?
I wasn't paying any attention anymore, though. Dwarfed and humbled by the immensity of the structure, I turned my gaze to the top of the stairs and the small balcony which overhung the whole area. What's at the very top? My guide shrugged, seemingly losing interest in me.
Dunno. No one's ever had enough points to unlock that door. Not for as long as I've been here.
How long have...
Diggory, Mexi, ground floor, let's go. People dying over here.
And he was gone, leaving me adrift in the swirling profusion between life and death. Overwhelmed and disorientated, I continued to climb the stairs, driven as much to isolate myself as I was by curiosity. Past 500 points, and the crowd dissipated precipitously. Strange alien creatures began mingling with the dwindling remaining options. Seraphic beings with skin of light and shadow and golden-toned creatures of sublime beauty came and went as I continued to mount the lonely stairs. Finally, reaching the balcony at the very top, I turned to survey the whole mad spectacle flowing beneath me. The perspective was disorientating, though I'd only climbed a few flights of stairs. Looking down it seemed more like the view from an airplane window. All creatures were minuscule in their eager dance. All sounds had faded and combined into a single, omnipresent hymn. All sounds, that is, except for the rapid burst of knocking on the door behind me. It wasn't like the other doors. Its metallic composition seemed in perpetual motion, rippling and glistening like a pool of oil. Three ponderous iron bars were bolted across the frame to prevent it opening outward, each engraved with mystic runes beyond my comprehension. The knocking came again, rapid, urgent, a prisoner desperately calling for aid without wanting to alert the guards. Hello? Someone in there? A hissing sound like high-pressured steam bursting through its confinement. The bolts in the iron bars were beginning to slide outward. I rushed back to the balcony in search of my guide, but so far below, he had merged seamlessly with the throng. Behind me, a clanging sound had me jump. The first iron bar had dropped off to the ground.
Can anyone hear me?
But I was utterly alone. I took a half dozen steps towards the stairs, but at the clang of the second iron bar, I indecisively spun back. And why not? What was the worst that could happen now that I was already dead? That sentiment did not endure through the dropping of the third bar. The whole door shimmered like a mirage in the desert, then, without motion or warning, it was gone. Bile rose in my throat the instant I saw the creature. My legs buckled beneath me, and I crashed hard to my knees, vomiting profusely upon the ground. It wasn't food. Heaving again, my whole body convulsing from the swelling pressure, I released another dark torrent of blood. Lumps of degraded flesh, and even what appeared to be entire rotting organs, which laboriously wriggled up my throat and out of my mouth. I'd almost forgotten my own death for a while, but it immediately became clear that I'd not escaped as far as I thought.
"Come in,"
the creature commanded. I was powerless to refuse. Crawling through my own sick, not daring to look up again, I passed through the open door. Seeing it once had been enough. The humanoid being was swollen to the size of a cow, bloated with gas which unevenly malformed its corpulent frame. Open sores covered its body, weeping blood and pus to stream down its nakedness so thickly that it almost seemed a garment. Gaping mortal wounds punctured its chest and belly in many places, allowing clear sight all the way through to its broken and uneven ribs. Somehow, worst of all, the unblemished face of a young boy stared out from that mockery of human life.
"Are you alone?"
"More alone than I've ever been." I nodded, still not looking up. The room itself was minimal in the extreme, a concrete prison cell with no comfort besides a thin bamboo floor mat.
"Not any more?"
it said, hot, fetid air blowing across my face with each word.
Who are you?
I asked.
The final prize. Come, sit with me. Be at ease.
My body tensed so sharply that I thought I was about to vomit again. I remained on my knees.
Why would anyone want to be...
I stopped myself, but the child simply laughed with a sound like wind chimes.
No one would, but being at the top doesn't mean the best. It simply means that I have the greatest capacity to do good or evil. I can create life or end it. Does that sound like a power you'd want to have?
I shook my head, finally daring another glance. The creature had leaned forward on its mat, its terribly perfect face mere inches from mine. The boy sighed and leaned back once more.
Me neither, which is why I remain in this place. My influence is too great, and any good or evil I bring into existence is multiplied countless times. If I allow that to happen, then I will die with so many points that I am forced to be reborn within this same cursed form.
So you have the power to do anything, but instead you sit here and do nothing?
Not nothing. I wait to die. That's the only way for me to reset to 0 points and have another chance to begin again. Unless, of course...
The child's face was drawing closer. The stench was too foul to breathe through my nose, but even having the air enter my mouth was enough to taste its rot.
You invited me in to kill you, then?
I said it as matter-of-factly as I could, not wishing to cause offence.
You aren't the first, he said, gesturing at the wounds which scoured its body. But through revulsion or weakness or cowardice, each have failed so far. Will you be the one to show me mercy?
The thought of even getting close enough to harm the creature almost had me retching again. I still don't understand, though, I said, buying time. If you're the supreme power here, why can't you save yourself?
The supreme power?
Laughter like the wind, so sweet and so sad.
Death is the supreme power, and I am his servant like any other. Don't think I have not tried to take my own life before. The act carries such significance that I simply find myself reborn in this same body. Here, you will need this.
A trembling hand reached out to me, its obese fingers fused at the joints. I recoiled by reflex, but I felt such pity for the creature that I fought against my instincts to accept the black dagger from his grasp. How do I end you?
Through the eye, he begged.
Are you sure? Such a dazzling smile from such a loathsome creature. I can't imagine how much he must have suffered, and I'm sure I would have asked the same in his place. The cool dark metal felt righteous in my hand as I steeled myself for the killing blow. Some nagging doubt lingered in the back of my head, but I was so mesmerized by my disgust and sympathy that I could think of no other course. "Won't you at least close your eyes?" I asked. His smile widened, unnaturally so for the child's face.
"I've been looking forward to this moment for as long as I can remember. I'm not going to miss a moment."
Worried that any hesitation would steal my resolve, I took the dagger in both hands and plunged it deep. The eye did not close, even as the blade slipped through it. It cut so easily that I felt no resistance until the very hilt was embedded in the boy's face. The smile faltered for the briefest instant before returning, then grimacing again as though fluctuating between agony and ecstasy. The massive body trembled, but I didn't relinquish my grip until its last spasm overbalanced the monstrosity. I scrambled to get out of the way as it toppled face first towards me, slamming against the ground and further pounding the dagger within its skull. Crowds parted around me as I returned down the staircase. Claws and talons pointed at me with undisguised fascination. Whispers and murmurs from multifarious assembly swelled and faded like the ocean waves. "I think I'd like to come back as a cat," I told the koala when I found him again. He was easy enough to locate, standing out in the open, seemingly paralyzed by shock. Cats seem to have things figured out.
"Jason, Maxie,
Anyone?
The koala shouted in a hoarse, strained voice from the corner of his mouth, not taking his eyes off me for a moment.
What is it? Did I do something wrong?
An owl landed nearby, its head cocking from side to side to get a better look at me.
Hey, Nixie,
the koala said, still without turning.
How many points do you get for killing God? You have a number for that somewhere?
I swallowed hard, but I couldn't get rid of the dry lump in my throat.
You sure I didn't lose points?
He stared dumbly at his clipboard.
Considering what he would have done if you hadn't, yeah, says acts of mercy on here, you're way in the positive, my man.
I'm not going to become that thing, am I?
Not yet. You came here with 478, so that's what you're going back with. But shit, man, you've got so many now that...
Unless I can spend them all in the next life, right?
What?
Unless I bring so much evil into the world that I break even. That's what you're saying, right? The koala looked helplessly to the owl, who fluffed its wings in something resembling a shrug. Better to be human again, then, I said. I don't care what I have to do. I'm not going to live as that monster.
You're not serious, are you?
The koala whispered.
Do you have any idea what you'd have to do to...
I killed God, didn't I? Who knows what I'm capable of? Now that I'm back alive, I suppose I'm going to find out.
Night 42. Dreammaker music. Sleeping is the easiest, most natural thing in the world. Babies do it all the time without even being taught. It's so easy, people do it by accident. But not me. I suck at sleeping, which sometimes feels more like I suck at being human, since I'm so freaking tired all the time. It's the same battle every night. Even looking at the clock and knowing I should be in bed is enough to make me feel restless. I've tried keeping a rigid sleep schedule and burning soporific incenses and popping pills, but nothing seems to make a difference. You'd think my body would just get so tired it'd shut off automatically. But it seems like the less I sleep, the more agitated I get, thinking how much I need to, and the harder it is to make love with sweet oblivion. Anyway, my friend Anu told me her grandfather was this Indian guru who had a remedy for insomnia. My hopes were flying about as high as an iron pigeon, but I figured there wasn't any harm. Even if I couldn't sleep, at least I could impress the girl by being spiritually open to new ideas and respecting her culture, and all that shit. Is it wrong that I pat myself on the back for not being racist, just because it seems like everyone else is nowadays? Yeah, just thinking that is probably racist too. Point is, she gives me this album of Indian music that I'm supposed to listen to in bed. She says it's an instrument called the Ravanahatta, which is some kind of ancient precursor to the violin. It's made from a resonating gourd covered with goat hide and strings stretched across a bamboo neck. Legend has it, these particular songs were written to appease Shiva, the destroyer of worlds in Hindu scripture. It's supposed to be super calming and meditative, though, so I took it home with me to give it a go. The only weird thing is, right before we parted, Anu also said, "Oh, I almost forgot." He said not to try to stop the music before morning, because Shiva will be listening too. In hindsight, is Shiva a babe? Was probably not the most culturally sensitive question, but Anu still smiled. As a whole, I think the whole interaction was good for our chances of making beautiful, caramel-coloured babies down the road. That night, I gave the music a go. It was legitimately beautiful, kind of a longing, soulful sound, but not in a sad way. There was just enough lively melodic lift that it felt more like the serenity of seeds buried deep beneath the snow, just waiting for their chance to bloom. Next comes the part where I try to trick my brain into sleep. It feels like playing that, "Did I put the poison in my drink or yours?" game, as I alternate between thinking the music will work or not, and whether even having expectations will influence the results. Next, surprisingly enough, came a deep and peaceful sleep, and the strangest dream I've ever had in my life, almost more like an out-of-body experience.
I was only aware I was sleeping at all because I was looking down at my body while it slept. I could even still hear to the music down below, like I was watching myself in a movie. It didn't take long to discover my consciousness was free to move around my house, leaving my sleeping body behind. That part was a lot of fun. I just sort of drifted around, shifting my focus like I was imagining different perspectives. But everything was so clear and perfect that it felt exactly like I was actually seeing it. I could even count the number of dishes in my sink, 6, mind your own business, and see the minuscule detail in the wood grain floor. I was just about to float over to the living room and see if I could watch TV when I heard the first sound other than the music. The rattle of a handle, and then the opening of my front door. I startled so badly that I woke up immediately, seemingly teleporting into my bed. Frantic reality checks, the texture of my blanket, my phone beside my bed, the clock reading 2:31. Everything seemed normal again. That's why I flinched so badly when I heard the front door slam closed. Panic. Hyperventilate. Lie flat and pretend I'm asleep. I really need a better defense plan. I held my breath for a full 10 seconds, but I didn't hear any other sounds. Creeping out of bed, I sped through my apartment in a commando crouch, flipping on every light as I passed. It didn't take long before I cleared the last room, all empty. The front door was closed and locked. I couldn't help but count the 6 dishes in my sink and congratulate my dream memory on its accuracy. Figuring I just heard a neighbor's door slam really loud, I turned off the lights and went back to bed. Seconds later, I was hovering above my bed, watching myself sleep. Except I wasn't the only one in the room. Someone was sitting in the chair beside my bed, also known as the I haven't decided if these clothes are dirty chair. My clothes had been moved onto the floor to make space for it. Naked bone, white skin, androgynous yet strong features, and long strings of prayer beads characterized my visitor. But nothing stood out more than a pair of living green snakes which sinuously writhed around his throat. He was watching my sleeping body at first, but ponderous and implacable as a flowing glacier, he turned his gaze to meet my perspective. He watched me through heavy, half-closed eyes, nodding his head in time with the music. Seeing his tranquility, I allowed myself to drift closer to get a better look. Approaching him was the most disorientating experience of my life. As I drew closer, his body seemed to grow larger as normal perspective dictates, but his eyes grew at an exponentially larger rate as though they were gargantuan celestial bodies that I was speeding towards. Soon, my room and his body and everything else became insignificant to the cosmic eyes which stretched from horizon to horizon. I had to pull myself back for fear of falling in, at which point everything returned to normal. Almost normal. His necklace of snakes was gone. They'd slithered up my bed, their thick coils sliding effortlessly over my corporeal body's legs. It was enough of a start to wake me up again. I immediately began my reality checks, blanket, phone, clock. Then I noticed the pile of clothes on the floor, the ones that used to be on the chair. My heart was beating so fast and the music was so loud that I couldn't hear myself think. I numbly shut off the music, trying to catch my breath for long enough to figure out if I'd somehow knocked the clothes onto the floor myself. Something touched my foot under the blankets, so cold and smooth, almost slimy. A wave of tension ran up my body, overflowing into the thing touching me, whose rigid coils loaded like a spring. I couldn't hover anymore, but shit could I jump. Tangled in my own sheets, I flopped and lurched through the air like an Olympic slug. I hit the floor hard, but I didn't slow down until I'd wriggled free from the blankets and raced the light switch by the door. 2 long green snakes with black and yellow markings emerged from the blanket on the ground behind me. They recoiled momentarily from the light, but one of them launched back at me, striking, sinking its fangs into my calf. I spotted at it and immediately let go and backed off again, but it stung like 1,000 bee stings, one right on top of the other. I ran from the bedroom and slammed the door. A forked tongue darted out beneath, swiftly followed by the head of the serpent, which easily slipped through the crack. I stomped it, and it withdrew. But the second snake was already halfway out, far enough to rear its head, and tense for another strike. I turned and ran. My leg was on fire as I hobbled out of my apartment and my boxers and dashed towards my car. The place it bit me was swelling by the second, and I knew I had to get to a hospital ASAP. By the time I got there, I was almost blind. My throat had swollen to the size of a pinhole, and the pressure in my chest was excruciating. I parked right up on the curb and managed to tumble out of my car, and I was vaguely aware of some people helping me into a wheelchair after that. When I woke, they told me I was bitten by an Indian pit viper, which confused the shit out of them because they don't exist anywhere in the Americas. I had an animal services guy sweep my apartment before I got home, but he didn't find anything. He did have this helpful tidbit of reassurance to give me, though. Of course, snakes aren't going to be found when they don't want to be. Shit, I knew a lady who had a 10-foot boa living in her house left over from the last tenant. It was over a month before she even saw the bugger. If I don't play the music, then all I can do is lie awake, listening to the approaching, slithering, and agitated hiss in the darkness. If I do play it, the dream comes again without fail, and I'm forced to watch the stranger enter my room and sit down beside my bed. Like I wasn't already having enough trouble getting some sleep. Night 43. The girl on the leash. 10, maybe 12 years old, wearing a leash attached to one of those dog training collars with the inward-facing spikes. She was sitting on the balcony of my neighbor's apartment, her dirty bare legs dangling through the iron bars. She stared at me where I sat with my book on my own balcony, so I gave her a little wave. She didn't so much as blink in return. She just kept swinging her legs through the bars and staring. I figured the collar was some kind of ironic fashion accessory, although it hardly matched with her threadbare summer dress. 5 minutes later, she was still staring, and I was beginning to feel a little uncomfortable. I set my book down and asked, "What's your name, Missy?" "He calls me Cheesy," she replied, flashing all her little teeth like she was posing for a picture. "That's an unusual name." "'Cause he says I make him sick, like cheese."
"Oh." I looked down at my book. How the hell was I supposed to reply to that?
"Are we friends now?"
she asked, squishing her face between the bars.
"Okay, friends."
I couldn't help but smile at her innocent charm.
"Can I call you something other than Cheesy, though?"
"He also calls me Cockroach," she chirped conversationally. "Little freak, shitface."
"Who calls you these things? Your father?"
But she didn't get a chance to reply. A vicious tug on the leash tightened the spikes into her throat. Her fingers clutched at it, but she couldn't loosen the grip. A moment later, and she was helplessly reeled back into her apartment. I ran to the edge to look, but my view was obstructed by the jutting concrete which separated the balconies. I just saw her being dragged inside, and then heard,
"What did I tell you about talking to strangers?"
"He asked me a question."
"I knew it was a mistake to let you outside."
The sliding glass door slammed. I couldn't make out anything after that. My stomach felt like I'd just eaten a pound of garbage. I'd never spoken to my neighbor before, the severe, quiet man who wore dark sunglasses inside and out. I didn't even know he had a kid. He didn't seem like the type, although there's a chance she wasn't even his. Either way, I called Child Protective Services to let them decide. They thanked me for the information and said they would send someone over. I walked around the rest of the day, feeling like a hero. I had a few errands to run, but I got back just in time to see an authoritative black woman in a pristine blue suit standing outside my neighbor's open door.
"I'm sorry, there must have been some mistake," he said from inside his apartment. "I live alone, no kids."
"My apologies, I must have gotten the wrong address," she said. "Would you mind if I take a peek inside, just so I can check off my forms?"
The pause was slightly too long.
"No, that's not okay. This is my home, my sanctuary. Go bother someone else."
"It'll only take a few..."
The door slammed shut.
The woman immediately began knocking again, but there was no response.
"Excuse me, CPS?" I asked.
She looked me up and down, as though evaluating my potential to be a scumbag.
"You the guy who called?" she asked.
I nodded. "What's your next step?"
"My next step? What's your next step?"
she snapped. "I don't have any next steps without a signed warrant from a judge, and I'm not going to get that without some evidence. You get a picture or anything?" I shook my head.
"Well, call me if you do."
She was already halfway to the elevator.
"That's it?"
"What do you mean, that's it? I got 3 more cases tonight, and chances are at least one of them isn't going to be as pretty as this. I got a job to do, honey, but I can't do it here." Sounds like I had a job to do, too. He couldn't stay in there forever, right? Either he'd leave with her and I could follow them, or he'd leave alone and I'd have a chance to talk with her and find out what was going on. I brought my book into the hallway and sat down to wait. Half an hour did the trick. The door opened and Sunglasses gave a quick, paranoid scan. They landed on me.
"What are you doing?"
he asked. "Lost my key," I lied. "Gotta wait for my roommate to get home." He disappeared back inside, and the door closed. I thought I missed my chance, but a moment later, the door opened again, and he exited with Cheesy. She was still wearing the collar, but the leash was bundled up, and he rested his hand on her shoulder so it was barely visible. As they passed, she glanced back at me as if to say, "Goodbye, friend." But it wasn't goodbye yet. I followed them out of the building while pretending to stare at my phone, but I couldn't get a clear shot of the collar. I snapped one of them together, but that didn't seem like enough for a warrant yet. I might feel like a masquerading pillar of vigilante justice, but I certainly wasn't as smooth as one. By the time the pair had gotten to their car, the man must have noticed me 12 times. The chase was on. We'd only been out in the night for about 5 minutes when he suddenly pulled off the road into a dirt clearing beside some cornfields. I was so caught up in the excitement that I hadn't even paused to consider what I would do when I actually caught them. He must have known his secret was out, though, and if something happened to the girl tonight, I'd never forgive myself. I pulled off the road and parked behind him while dialing 911.
"Put the phone down!"
The man had gotten out of his car. He walked around to the passenger side to drag the girl out by the leash. The powerful yanks sent the clear signal about who would pay the price if I didn't obey. I hung up and got out of the car.
"Did I tell you to get out?"
he barked.
"Back in. Keep driving." "What the hell is wrong with you?"
I shouted, vainly hoping to draw some attention to our dark road. The man flinched at the sound.
"Where'd you get off on putting a collar on? If you knew her, you'd do the same. Or worse,"
he growled, his hands turning white from clenching the leash so hard.
"This little freak deserves it."
"Daddy, I can't breathe," the girl whimpered.
"Shut your disgusting mouth."
I couldn't take it anymore. I barreled headlong into the man, throwing him against his car. One of his arms was tangled in the leash, and that gave me a chance to pin his free arm and punch him across the face. The man slid to the ground, dragging the girl with him as she clutched at a collar and howled. I couldn't divert my attention long enough to unfasten the collar, so I just stomped on the man's hand that was holding the leash.
"Goddamn idiot," he shouted. "Do you have any idea how long it took me to capture her in the first place? Now look what you've done."
I did look, and damn was I proud. The man lay there nursing his hand while I unfastened the collar from around the girl's neck. She was grinning from ear to ear.
"I'm going to call the police now," I warned him, stripping his wallet and ID. "You better stay put unless you want the collar on you." "Don't bother," he moaned. "We'll both be dead before they arrive."
An idle threat from a desperate man, or so I thought. Until I glanced back at Cheesy. I guess I hadn't noticed how long her neck was under the metal collar. At least twice as long as a neck ought to be, and it was growing by the second. I swallowed hard, but it felt like there was cotton in my throat.
"What are you waiting for?"
the man shouted, all pretense of discretion gone.
"Run!"
The neck was still stretching. Her figure stayed the same. Her face was all smiles. But her neck was almost as long as her whole body now. It twisted sinuously through the air, as though it had no bones at all, stretching luxuriously after its confinement. Little Freak wasn't such a bad name. Did you know that most of their body is a hollow cavity which stores their folded neck? Or that silver collars were the only way to keep them from extending? I certainly didn't. Not until I read the papers stuffed in his wallet. Not before I stood in shocked awe on the side of the road and watched her jaw unhinge to consume him whole.
"Police dispatch, what is your emergency?"
faintly droned in my phone. "Friends?" I asked the girl. She nodded, choking the man's still squirming body into her grotesquely swollen neck. "Friends," I repeated as I hung up the phone, backing into my car. Her eyes watched me while she continued to gag the body down. Well, shit. So much for being a hero. But at least I was still a hero to her.
9:44. What the blind man sees. I'll never see her face again. If my blindness only meant scrubbing this dirty world into an ocean of black mist, then I think I could learn to accept that. Stealing my wife from me before her time, though, that I'll never forgive. It's bad enough that she's sick and fading from me already, but not being able to see her to say goodbye is killing me as surely as it is her. I suppose it's my fault, though. I spent the last few nights leading up to my accident shifting around the rigid hospital chair beside her bed. I was so tired that I could barely walk straight, and all it took was a patch of black ice in the parking lot to pitch me to the ground. My head slammed into the asphalt, and everything went dark. The black mist didn't lift, but next I could remember, I was sitting in my own hospital bed, with the nurse explaining what had happened.
"Post-traumatic cortical blindness," she was saying. "It seems like there was some damage to your occipital cortex when you hit the ground."
"Where's Sarah? Where's my wife? I want to see her." The nurse just coughed, giving me time for my own words to sink in.
"There is the chance your vision loss has been caused by pressure on the optic nerve, which can be potentially corrected with surgery. The doctor doesn't want to get your hopes up, though. You should be prepared to adjust to life without sight."
It's true that I couldn't see the nurse, or the hospital room, or even my own hand an inch from my face. But the worst thing was that I could still see. It just wasn't the same world I had left behind. I fumbled for words trying to explain the black and purple vines which dangled around me from unfathomably tall trees. How they swayed gracefully in an unfelt wind, bending across their hundreds of joints like fingers bending back and forth upon themselves. I pointed at the greasy orange sky and the swarms of softly teeming insects which obliviously paraded towards me from all sides.
"Hallucinations aren't unheard of after acute vision loss."
It was hard to take her seriously when her voice seemed to be coming from a giant blue flower, whose bell-shaped petals were deep enough for me to stand in. If this was a hallucination, then it was clearer and more vivid than anything I could have possibly imagined. I tried again to explain the infinitesimal detail of the insect's uneven carapaces, but she excused herself to leave without letting me finish. I never even got the chance to tell her that I could feel the thousands of tiny legs crawling up my body as the insect parade passed through the origin of disembodied perspective. I was stuck somewhere between worlds. I could still feel the coarse fabric of the hospital blanket, but so could I feel the smooth gloss of each leaf and barky tree in the sudden jungle I was mired within. I pulled on one of the purple digits, only to see it coil around my arm, inquisitively feeling me in return. I tore away from it and tried to stand, leaning on a cold metal IV pole that I couldn't see. I felt like I was going insane, and there was no amount of reasonably toned nurses or insightful doctors that would convince me otherwise. I knew instinctively that I had to find my wife. Sarah was the only real thing left to ground me in the world I was supposed to be in. It wasn't easy navigating two worlds at once. Even when I shuffled around until I found the door to my room, I still had to push myself through a thick curtain of fingers, which had inconveniently
infested the portal. It was slow going, navigating the invisible hallways while ploughing through the thick jungle foliage. And to make matters worse, the blue-white sun was beginning to smoulder and set